If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Live from London with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
Good morning, world. It's Friday. We love it, don't we? But we love every day around here. And why ever not? Welcome to the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. Do not go anywhere. It is wonderful to have you here with us. You can take us, you know, because we're on the app. Even if you're walking your dog, you're in the car, driving the kids to school, whatever it is you're doing, we can do it with you. And I just want to say thank you to Annette. Annette wrote in saying thank you to TNT for making my day. I only recently discovered your show and now we leave TNT on the whole day in our workshop. It's become essential listening. And this is exactly the type of thing that is guaranteed to put a smile on my face, because obviously the whole idea is to bring you lovely people over to our station because we have so much to share with you. And congratulations to one of our regular chatters, Craig Campbell. His tweet about Madeleine McCann has gone viral with over 5 million views. That's an awful lot of people who now know that an important witness, Martin Smith from Ireland, claimed that he and his family, on the night of May the 3rd, 2007, the night that Madeleine McCann was reported missing, Martin Smith claimed that he saw a man carrying a child and he gave a witness testimony saying he was 60 to 80% certain it was Jerry McCann. And Craig's tweet saying that has gone over 5 million views. That's phenomenal. Right. Last night, when I was looking for a book, this book fell out on the floor. It is called The Brotherhood. It's an old book, fairly old book. It's written by Stephen Knight. You may or may not know it. It is about Freemasonry. And it made me think again, as I always do, as I often do in my work, because it would be impossible in my work not to think about Freemasonry. And it is exactly the invisible membership that explains so much about our world. It's a parallel universe. It informs our law, our education, our banks, all public offices, including Parliament and royalty. They have their own code, their own symbolisms. There are at least 5 million members worldwide, although we don't know the exact figure because it's a secret society. They have been accused of all manner of dark deeds. It's notoriously difficult to confirm who is a Freemason. And believe me, I've tried because of the vow of silence. But there are famous members in history: Mozart, Walt Disney, Winston Churchill, Louis Armstrong, George Washington. And as I say, they have rituals, they have degrees, they have vows of silence. There's nothing that is allowed really to seep into the outside world. The Freemasons trace their foundations to around London 1717. The craft, as members call it, was based on a bond created by ritual and symbolism. The aim was moral education, that's what we're told, about building a better man. Crucially, however, all of this was to be conducted in seclusion from the outside world. And no wonder the movement has been open to so much misunderstanding over the years, and the secrecy has definitely helped that. Now, many people believe that Stephen Knight was murdered for writing this book. He died before he was able to complete his proposed follow-on to the Brotherhood. It was claimed he had a terminal illness, a brain tumour that had been removed previously. It was said that he had a long-term illness. But here's what was really interesting. For somebody who was supposedly aware that they were dying, I've never really understood why he wrote some of the things that he did in the Brotherhood, including talking about his stated intention to do a follow-up on Freemasonry. He mentioned in the publication that Freemasonry can be a really important factor in government, particularly in civil service and in some ministries, for example, defence. It can be an absolute disadvantage not to be a Mason. He said that the Masonic influence in the civil service warranted a book by itself. He said it will command an entire section in future editions of the Brotherhood when more detailed research was completed. Hardly the words of a man who knew he had a terminal illness. But here's where it gets a little bit funny. It does not escape my attention that Stephen Knight died at the age of 33. In Freemasonry, there are numbers and stages that you pass through: apprentice, journeyman, master, and then there are the 33 degrees of the Scottish Rite. That is right up there. There will be people listening to this saying, but my local Freemasons are fantastic. They take care of the disabled and poor in the community. And yes, absolutely, I'm sure they do. But there are many troubling aspects to the craft that should not be ignored. The issue of secrecy is absolutely one of them. Do Freemasons assist each other in business, in law, in the workplace? I've talked with cops who told me that they felt the odd one out because they were not in the local lodge. So is there a substance to this claim? Absolutely. I mean, it's almost impossible to substantiate some of it because of the secrecy, but we've heard some examples in history that have come out in the public domain. For one example, there was the Lancashire Police Authority who were obliged to pay £70,000 to a father and son who were assaulted and then arrested and prosecuted after stumbling on a Masonic dinner being hosted by a lodge dominated by the local police officers. And certainly Jimmy Savile was very involved with Freemasonry. He had his Friday morning chats with the cops at his place. It's like a Freemasonic lodge there. That's one example, or those are two rather, but I know through my work that Freemasonry is the invisible hand, the invisible guiding hand nationally and internationally. They should never be dismissed just as people working in the community doing good, because behind the cloak of secrecy hides the potential for a multitude of sins. And on that note, let's find out about the UK headlines from Gemma Cooper.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make America great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA, it's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here she is, fresh from the lodge, is Gemma Cooper. How are you, Gemma? I'm kidding, of course. Absolutely kidding.
Be careful, Sonia. Not only did he get bumped off before he could write his sequel, you'll get bumped off TNT, not by the bosses, obviously, but by the nefarious, shadowy organizations running the world that are definitely listening. Definitely now. We're so over the target and our audience is growing so much, as you just rightly said. Another set of listeners to add to the TNT army. Fantastic. Welcome aboard. But you be careful. Be careful. He clearly wasn't on his way out, was he? Until he started, saying the things that we shouldn't be saying about how the world is really run. So be careful. That's all I'll say. That's all I'll say.
Well, thank you. Now, before you tell us about the headlines, got to read this from Teresa on Twitter. Good morning to you, Teresa. Happy broadcasting, she says this morning. You and Gemma are fantastic together. The energy bounces off the screen. We love that. Thank you very, very much. Much appreciated. That's lovely, isn't it, Gemma? We get lots of compliments about, obviously, us working together. And it's always wonderful. I always appreciate hearing it. I really do. So, Gemma, over to you. Tell us what's on your radar.
Well, firstly, thank you very much for that very nice compliment. I enjoy getting them as well. It was funny, when I was in my old employer, the BBC, they would do everything they possibly could to make you feel that you weren't good enough, that you never went down well with the viewers, that you just were, a cog in the machine, because they didn't want anyone to get too big for their boots and think they were bigger than the organisation, which I never would have done. And certainly here at TNT, it's really nice to get compliments and be able to say, thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching, however you're engaging with the station. And please spread the word. Spread the word. We are the alternative to the lamestream legacy dinosaur media. Funny, Sonia, though, this morning that you should be talking about Freemasonry and the military, because every single story is about defence this morning and the way they weave together so perfectly, these stories. You would almost think that somebody had a conversation behind closed doors and thought, right, these are the stories we'll release today. And I'm going to call it Fighting Friday, because they really are adding to this rhetoric about war, defence, and pushing us towards this somehow inevitable conclusion of World War III. Well, I think we'll stop it in its tracks right now. The first headline, which really can't be ignored, is that Labour will announce today, Sir Keir Starmer will announce today, that if they win the election, they will increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. This will match the Tories' pledge. Don't know where they're going to find the money from, but that's what they are pledging to do. Sir Keir Starmer is visiting Barrow-in-Furness in Cumbria, where they make nuclear submarines, and he's expected to announce that we're going to build four more nuclear submarines if Labour get into power. Interestingly, what he has said is defence is the number one issue for both parties in the election. News to the electorate. I think at the NHS and immigration are the number one and two issues, or joint first issues in the election. But no. Defence. So I'll keep an eye on that and hopefully bring more throughout the day here on TNT. Interesting as well, the former defence minister, James Heapy, who only quit a couple of weeks ago from his post, has said the thing I knew we were going to start hearing. Last week, we heard dodgy Dave Cameron, our foreign secretary, saying absolutely no UK troops to Ukraine, right? No UK troops. I thought, well, we can turn that on its head. That's going to mean UK troops in Ukraine. Today, James Heapy, former defence minister at the front line of our armed forces until he quit, said the UK should send troops to Ukraine. The government should seriously consider it. Now, he should know. He's the former defence minister. So clearly there's conversations going on behind closed doors, and he can speak more freely now that he has quit his post. And staying with the armed forces, this headline, I mean, you just can't believe it. Our Royal Navy facing the worst recruitment and retention crisis ever. It's the worst of all our armed forces in the UK, all of which are struggling. It's now announced that don't worry if you can't swim, you can still join the Royal Navy. There you go, Sonia. Couldn't make it up.
I mean, where to start, Gemma? Where would you like to start on any one of those?
Well, I think they all link together, actually, yes, because I was surprised to see so many headlines about defence and spending and this line, UK troops in Ukraine. You know, the minute I heard our unelected foreign secretary last week say, we won't send troops, I thought it's like George W. Bush Sr., no new taxes. Remember that, Sonia? Where he said, read my lips, no new taxes. What happened? The US had all these, you know, crippling taxes. So that's what we can, you know, really set our stall on, is whatever the top politicians are saying, tip it on its head. And in a few months' time, we'll get the opposite. And it's not even a few months, it's a few days. James Heapy, former defence minister, quit amid, you know, defence spending being one of the issues that he was said to have quit on. The budget didn't give any money. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's budget didn't give any money to the armed forces at a time when they're really, really struggling. And surprise, surprise, just after the budget, James Heapy announced not only was he quitting his post as defence minister, he was also stepping down from being an MP, joining the other 63 Tory MPs that have said, enough's enough, we're quitting at the next election. I clearly think that given his senior role in government, he knows something. He's now free to speak out. He's quit his post. And this morning he's saying the UK government should seriously consider sending troops to Ukraine, which means they are, you know, read between the lines. It means that's what they're doing. He's also says the UK needs to invigorate a large reserve of veterans and create this fighting force of former soldiers who've all been trained. They all know what they're doing, and bring them back into the fold and create this reserve force, almost like a territorial army. Whether or not there'd be appetite for that from former service personnel who've seen the reality of war, you know, after joining up in good faith and then seeing the real nefarious aspects of war and vested interests once you're in the front line. But I do think that the story is well about the Royal Navy. Oh, don't worry if you can't swim. We'll teach you. Anyone can come through the doors now. But interestingly, just earlier in the week, I covered a story here. I gave it a few mentions. I didn't go into it in depth about a woman who quit the Royal Navy. She was tipped for the top to be the first ever female submarine captain. She quit under what she says is a horrendous culture of misogyny, sexual assault, and even rape. She quit the Royal Navy 18 months ago, and she's still waiting for the results of an inquiry that the Navy says was launched when she reported the bad behaviour. She says she feels she's been hung out to dry. Now she's left, and the Navy will never admit the truth about what it's like actually working there. So I think that's one of the reasons with the Navy is clutching at very big straws here. I think their problems are much deeper than just recruits that can't swim.
This is really interesting you've brought this, that the three stories and defence, as you say, that's probably news to the British electorate, that defence is suddenly top of our agenda. And we had Warren Thornton on yesterday, journalist, former aid worker, journalist who sort of specialises in covering war, for as one example. And what he was saying was thousands of staff have left the Army, Royal Navy over the last year. And that also explains why we've had all this propaganda about conscription, as one example. And isn't it interesting, Gemma, that we have a depletion of Army and Navy personnel in the UK, yet they're planning on sending them off to fight in another country? I mean, I find that extraordinary. It's almost almost like the decisions that are being made are not being made in the best interests of the British people. I know that's probably shocking for everybody out there, but it's almost like, Gemma, that they're being made on a global stage. And of course, we know that they are. And this is what globalism is all about. It really is about putting the interests of the sort of global stage first rather than the country. And I think we're all sick of it, aren't we? Aren't we really sick of politicians who aren't representing our interests? They're representing international interests and what the cabal wants. And I think, you know what, if honestly, I think that in this election year, if we had a politician that really stood up and was true to their word and came with, you know, clean hands, which is always very, very difficult because for some reason, a lot of people who gravitate towards politics are just filthy creatures. But if we had a politician who had clean hands and could say, listen, we're going to stop all this. We're going to stop sending aid. We're going to look into the foreign aid budget. I think it would make a real difference. And instead, what we get, of course, Gemma, is all this madness where they keep doing these sort of Rwandan votes and all of that, the costs of their just craziness going on, but no actual action. And these headlines disturb me. And I think you're absolutely right to group them all together, because as you said, at the absolute start of this, or as you intimated, this isn't an accident that all of this has just come out all at the same time. And you know it, Gemma, you're particularly good at seeing the big picture and how they all the jigsaw pieces fit together. So, yeah, that's really good stuff. So, I mean, it's not good stuff. We hate it. We absolutely hate it. But we love the fact that Gemma can bring it to us. Gemma, anything else to add on that?
Well, just that you were talking about it being part of the cabal, and absolutely that is true, because if you look at what Keir Starmer is going to say today when he's at the nuclear subplant in Barrow-in-Furness, he's saying that he's committed to NATO and he's going to bump up GDP spending to 2.5% on defence. Well, what did Donald Trump say just a week or so ago? If you're not paying your way in NATO, we're not going to support you. And suddenly, you know, Labour is, they're not trying to appease the electorate and say, oh, this is the number one issue, defence. They're trying to appease Donald Trump, who they clearly know is going to win the US election. So Trump has been very clear. If you don't pay your way in NATO, I'm not helping you if you're in trouble. So 2.5%, we promise, honestly, Donald Trump, is to do with appeasing other world leaders. Nothing to do with the UK electorate or our money. Don't forget, 2.5% of GDP is our money. It's not government money. It's our money. I haven't heard a single person that I've spoken to about politics in the election, which I am a lot at the moment because I'm working for TNT. I haven't heard anyone mention defence. It is NHS and immigration. In fact, it's immigration and then the NHS. That's what the electorate are concerned about. That's what the politicians need to focus on, but they're too busy pleasing their globalist counterparts across the pond. I'm not suggesting Trump is a globalist, but I do, you know, he's going to be a world leader again, and he does carry a lot of clout. So this is clearly about, you know, keeping vested interests and also boosting British defence contracts as well. You know, if you're going to build four more nuclear submarines, it won't just be British parts. There will be other components in that. There's all kinds of things going on with this. But to see these three headlines on a Friday morning, let's call it Fighting Friday, but let's all of us fight back.
Absolutely. Couldn't think of three more perfect headlines to follow an opening editorial about Freemasonry, frankly. Gemma, we will see you in the second hour. We will be right back.
Right now, the forgotten poor are waiting for healing and care, for life-saving medical care, for a chance to live with dignity and hope. They are waiting for Mercy Ships and you. Mercy Ships is the largest floating civilian hospital in the world, with volunteer medical staff and crew who donate their time to save lives. And now, as our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship sets sail, Mercy Ships will double our ability to reach children and adults who need us now.
Without the work of Mercy Ships, these patients don't have another option.
Mercy Ships is answering the call to serve suffering people who have nowhere else to turn. Together, we are going to some of the world's most desperate places and bringing a wave of hope and healing to those who need it most. To learn more about this wave of hope, go to mercyships.org today.
So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Well, Gemma, as ever, I've got you all talking. Shug says, traitors want our children to die for them, in short. I've always said, I mean, I'm opposed to war for the most part anyway, because we all know that they manufacture consent for it. But I've always said, for the most part, that when I start to see politicians put their children on the front line, I may take a different look at what is actually going on. Right, let us move on. As ever, I am delighted to welcome a regular guest, Dr. Bruce Scott. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Sonia. How's it going?
Good to have you with us. Really good to have you with us. For those who are not familiar with Bruce, he's a psychoanalyst, he's an author, he's a commentator, and somebody that we really enjoy on TNT for his insights. So, Bruce, there was a story that came up this week, and you were literally the first person I thought of when I saw it, because I know that you and I have talked. We talked throughout the last 4 years. You've been on many shows with me, and we've talked about the psychological machinations that have taken place and the manipulations regarding us, regarding COVID. And one of the things that both you and I felt was utterly remiss over the last 4 years was the intervention of mental health charities. We both felt they should have done more, and they failed to. And yet this week, Mind calls on UK's COVID-19 inquiry to consider mental health impact of pandemic. And that obviously comes in the wake of the UK COVID inquiry deciding not to tackle the mental health aspects of COVID. Bruce, tell us your thoughts when you saw this headline. I know you weren't pleased.
I was actually disgusted to see this, because myself and other people 4 years ago were warning mental health organisations, psychology organisations, psychotherapy organisations, charities, that this would end up being a mental health catastrophe, which it has. And they come out now in 2024, 4 years later, to come out with, we really need the mental health discussed. It's far, far too little, too late. You know, interestingly, on the Mind website, they still have all the coronavirus information. They still all have the how to cope in a pandemic. And I'll give you a quote from their website. This is still up in their website. If you're experiencing these emotions, the negative emotions from the pandemic, you need to remind yourself of the following. It is understandable to experience difficult feelings about the coronavirus pandemic, especially after living through it for so long. There is no normal response to a pandemic. In other words, they're trying to normalize the abnormal for the response that's actually occurred, which they're complaining about suddenly after 4 years. And on their website, they've got resources, cognitive behavioral therapy resources, how to deal with negative emotions and negative automatic thoughts. Well, of course, I wrote an article way back about this on the UK column about ethical psychotherapy versus the pandemic kind of abnormal thinking way about it, how dangerous it is for ordinary people, you know, with no underlying conditions. And the idea behind CBT is you analyse the real danger in the world. You say, well, how much at risk am I? And of course, a CBT therapist would say, well, you're not at risk for dying, so don't worry. But the whole government narrative and all the other charities' narrative was about fear, fear, fear. So in one hand, they're giving out treatment, but it's treatment advice, but it's contra to the philosophy behind the treatment. It is an utter double bind. This is Mind, the mental health organisation, one of the biggest ones in the UK, and they're proffering the double bind model. On one hand, they're giving out, oh, we care, but at the same time, they're being duplicitous, and double thing. It's really, really disgusting, you know. And people who suffered during the pandemic, you know, this last 4 years, the so-called pandemic. In ordinary circumstances in history, when there's catastrophes, holocausts, massacres, etc., people are allowed to remember and comment and to have a kind of almost truth and reconciliation sort of scenario. What's happening now is like a whitewash with this COVID, with the inquiries, with them sidelining it. But I think, you know, I'm quite sceptical of their open letter, Mind's open letter, because I think it's, they're worried about if mental health is going to be top priority for getting cash from the government. That's what I think is going in here.
Right. Well, now, Bruce, we're going to discuss that when we come back after the headlines. But so I'm just looking at some of these 30 organisations that had written this open letter. And some of the questions that they've asked is, why was there no public mental health plan? Why did those with pre-existing mental health conditions die at 5 times the rate of the general population? What help was given to our frontline staff? Why were the psychiatric hospitals emptied all at the same time that community care was shut down? Now, those are brilliant, brilliant questions, but asking them 4 years after the fact really beggars belief, doesn't it? Listen, let us go to some news headlines and come back and let's continue digging deep on this.
What's happening?
Newsflash.
TNT Radio News.
Hey! For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, has been detained in London's Belmarsh prison for 5 years, a situation Amnesty International described as a mockery of the USA's international law obligations. Russia is contemplating the deployment of its intermediate-range nuclear-capable missiles, possibly alongside China, in response to the United States' revival of such weapons, according to the Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
And I'm here with Dr. Bruce Scott, and we're just discussing the absolute disgust that we have about 30 organisations coming together writing to the UK COVID inquiry about the mental health implications of the scamdemic. And Bruce has been horrified about this really pretty much from 2020, haven't you, Bruce? But what I was reminded of last night, Bruce, when I was preparing for our conversation today, was whether, because you just brought up the issue of money, and I just wondered whether these charities were compromised, because obviously they often receive a sizable chunk of our money via the government. And certainly, May 2020, the government issued £22 million to a number of organisations to do with mental health. And so let me just look at some of them. And interesting ones, National Autistic Society, British Institute for Learning Disabilities. These are learning disabilities, but there are some for mental health, including the Samaritans Mental Health UK. And do you think that many charities and organisations are compromised into silence and were through the pandemic because of the funding?
Well, one has to wonder. I know that in Scotland, the care homes were threatened by the Scottish government to follow the restrictions, or they wouldn't be given indemnity for the abnormal restrictions placed upon people. In other words, if people were harmed and killed, etc., because of the restrictions, they would be held to account if they didn't help. So I believe that charities like Mind would have been told by the government if they didn't put the narrative up in their websites and disseminate the fear narrative, they would be compromised. I mean, the first sentence in their open letter, I think the first sentence in the letter is very important. It says, Mind and others warned the inquiry, COVID inquiry, risks letting down millions of people if it fails to put mental health on an equal footing with physical health. So they straight away, it's almost like saying, listen, don't relegate us down the money tree to physical, because physical health's in a dire state as well, because of what's happened the last 4 years. So it's basically a bun fight, I think, to reassert, grant recipient status for Mind, you know. But interestingly, Mind were the only group, mental health charity, that were giving able to go and speak at the COVID inquiry. What about all other organisations?
I do have a problem with that, because I'm looking at this press release that I was reading from, and actually it talks about how Mind were given £5 million, right? That's an extraordinary amount of money in order for you to remain objective to the subject, isn't it, really? And so those things, I think, are troubling. I think we need to ask about them. And I just wonder, like you say, it's too little too late, frankly. People have killed themselves throughout COVID, right, through because of mental health issues that they were dealing with. So, you know, what can this possibly do other than, I suppose, sort of, do you think they're looking to exonerate themselves in some way?
I think there'll be attempts to do that, because everywhere through, like, the scientific advisors, the psychologists from SPIB, to organisations, they're all trying to suddenly make out that, oh, mistakes were made. Blah blah blah. But I remember I said to you on another show when I was with you on another time. It seems to be targeted towards the next pandemic and the looming WHO treaty, because in the open letter from Mind, it talks about the idea of the next time there's a pandemic, what will be in place. Ugh. So they're still pushing this idea. How can a mental health organisation that's supposedly for the mental health of the population push this without questioning the statistics behind it, and whether
they're gaslighting us all?
Pandemic.
Yeah.
How can they they're trying to rewrite history. They're trying to normalise.
Exactly that, Bruce. Bruce, I'm very conscious of the time, and I don't want you to leave us today without some comment about the Scottish COVID inquiry. We know that it appears that there's more going on at the Scottish COVID inquiry than at the UK COVID inquiry, because obviously we now know that mental health is off the table for the UK COVID inquiry. But the Scottish COVID inquiry seems to be revealing more information than we're getting from the UK COVID inquiry, such as, for example, about do not resuscitate orders. And so what are your views about what's going on?
Well, yes. Biology Phenom on Twitter and also Rustler, I've talked a lot about this, Biology Phenom especially. But there's been witness statements from the various people have revealed some terrible things. Elderly people being starved and thirsty. Not being trapped in their room for over a year, not seeing their relatives when they're dying, DNRs and signatures on forms, which have been forged apparently in some instances regarding DNRs from relatives. It's quite incredible. To me, it strikes of gross maltreatment and torture, and it seems to be a criminal nature. And what I can't get over is the lack of coverage in the Scottish mainstream news. You know, there's been plenty about the hate crime bill, and which of course is an important issue, but I don't think it's the most pressing issue when people have been systematically being maltreated and are dying in these care homes, and there are some very, very odd bureaucratic things happening. And of course, some of the witness statements talked about the impact of mental health, saying that mental health in the community and our hospitals has plummeted. You know, this was known. Psychological research knew fine well the pandemic would have a detrimental effect and long term as well. This is why Mind not saying anything for so long, and all the other, even some of the witnesses at the COVID inquiries not saying anything, because this was known 4 years ago this would be the case. you know, it's very difficult to believe what one's seeing when people are being, you know, economical with the truth.
Right, right. And that, obviously that's negligent, isn't it, of Scottish media in particular regarding the Scottish COVID inquiry not to be covering it more fully. And as you say, people are having to turn to online commentators in order to be able to understand what has really taken place. But Bruce, mainstream media are complicit, of course. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I think, you know, for the mainstream media, especially in Scotland, to be ignoring, and it's down to a few people on social media, just ordinary people who are not, you know, employed by big organisations, doing this off their own back, who have done more for investigative journalism. It's a credit to people like that to do this research, but it shows you how incompetent a lot of these journalists are in Scotland for not even because I think they're told not to cover it because it's
I don't think it's incompetence, Bruce. I don't think it's incompetence. I think they're compromised. I mean that's my understanding of everything that I've seen. And certainly we knew that the government was using our taxpayer money in order to be able to, you know, pay these advertising budgets for media to scare the life out of us. So they're compromised. I think that's a huge part of it. They are complicit in what has taken place.
I agree. I think they have been presented with the evidence. People have sent them the evidence and they've just ignored it. And then they congratulate themselves on sometimes a key question they put to Nicola Sturgeon sometime. You know, and it's pathetic because people were asking much harder questions 4 years ago. Nicola Sturgeon and many others never followed the COVID regulations themselves. That's never even been touched. And of course, but we're all meant to be scared, you know.
People
see with their eyes, they perceive with their eyes, and you say, well, what's going on? I can see this. And then you tell someone, like a journalist, and they just walk away from you. And that's not a good thing.
Not a good thing at all. Bruce, thank you very much for coming on this morning, as ever, lending clarity to a really important conversation, the hypocrisy of the mental health charities writing to the COVID UK inquiry, and of course, what's going on in the Scottish COVID inquiry as well. Everybody, this has been Dr. Bruce Scott lending that much needed clarity. I'll be right back.
Military families often sacrifice precious time away from loved ones while serving our country. And for those with children, the separation can be especially difficult.
We were worried that with him leaving, that she would lose those connections with her dad.
Some of life's best moments happen between parents, children, and the pages of a good book. United Through Reading provides that connection.
You can watch your mom or dad read a book to you, and it almost feels like they're really there.
We ensure they remain a consistent, meaningful part of their children's lives, no matter the distance.
Just seeing Jacob recognize Daddy again after a long time just melted my heart.
And now, as we're facing greater isolation from our loved ones, United Through Reading is also available to veterans. Learn more about United Through Reading and download our free secure app at unitedthroughreading.org.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying, by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. To learn more, visit nature.org today.
You're listening to Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT.
I do love a good Dr. Bruce Scott insight of a Friday morning. Now, talking about insights, sometimes it feels as if we slipped into a parallel universe, doesn't it? With one madness after another being foisted upon us. But there is someone who understands how all of this interlinks together, from digital ID and Agenda 2030 to the trans agenda and the Great Reset. And I am delighted to be joined by him, whichever way it is. Either way, he's here, Dr. Simon Elmer. Good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning, Sonia. Nice to speak with you finally. And thank you for having me on your show.
Absolute pleasure. I'm delighted. I was absolutely delighted to see my producers talking with you. I was like, yes, absolutely. Because I know you've done some really stunning work. And we are, of course, going to talk about your books. You are, well, you're many things, really. You're co-founder and head of research at Architects for Social Housing. You write about the global biosecurity state, about the Great Reset, but about many things. Let us start off with something that is particularly dear to my heart, not in any positive way, and that is the legacy of Margaret Thatcher. It is actually the sort of her death anniversary week. I believe she died on the 8th. Her funeral was on the 17th. I actually protested outside her funeral, Simon, because I'm that kind of person. Simon, as far as you're concerned, because obviously people are very divided about Margaret Thatcher. People were outraged when she died. There were many people who were rejoicing like the witch is dead. And I'm not necessarily that kind of person, but I saw no good to her legacy. When you think of Margaret Thatcher, what do you think about?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I remember when she did die, and I did organise a sort of a wake, but it wasn't a wake which was being nice things about her. And I was in the pub. I was dressed up as a kind of a priest leaving this procession, and someone stopped me and said, "What are you doing?" And I explained. And he said, "You clearly weren't young enough to remember what she did to this country." And I said, "Oh, I remember what she did to this country." I think her legacy. You know, the other day I looked up. The UK debt when she took over in 1979 was about 40% of the gross domestic product. Now it's sort of pushing 100%. Now that didn't happen straight away. She had the windfall of the North Sea oil to kind of sustain her economic policies. But she basically oversaw the transition of the UK from being an industrial manufacturing economy into a financial services economy. And that's where we are now. She oversaw a much wider kind of movement with the birth of neoliberalism. She shared a lot, obviously, with Ronald Reagan. And it's got us to the point now where we have a fiat economy, where the economy is basically run by the central bank, the Bank of England. And they feel free to keep on printing money, which is causing enormous inflation and the problems we are in now. I think that's her big legacy, what she did to the economy of this country. And once she flicked that switch, once she deregulated banking, once she got rid of the industrial base structure, it's very hard to go back on that. And that's brought us to where we are right now.
She was our longest serving 20th century prime minister, to my understanding, right? I think it was 1979. I'm just looking for just some confirmation here. I'm sure you'll remember it. 1979 and 1990. And she was also obviously our first female prime minister as well. Nothing that I found particularly proud. I remember literally crying when she got in for a second term. I was actually in a nightclub, Limelight, in central London, and it was announced over the speaker. And I remember literally crying because I came from a background that absolutely loathed and detested her. We grew up with this whole idea that it was like, you know, milk snatcher Margaret Thatcher, and the things that she did to the miners as one example, the division that she created, you know, there is no society. All of these things just seem to be really anti-people and very divisive indeed. And that doesn't even include the type of people that she gathered around her either. So I do think it's very interesting, but I'm not quite sure in recent history if there is a more divisive prime minister. Do you think there is?
Well, her love child really was Tony Blair, who continued on her policies of privatization. He's a pretty divisive figure, isn't he? During lockdown, or towards the end of it, I went to see a film about, it was Safe and Effective, and they had various figures, political figures, Matt Hancock and so on. But when Tony Blair came up, and this was in a conservative meeting, the reaction was, you know, absolutely appalling. So he's kind of close as well, because he really continued on her process of privatization. It is interesting, though, isn't it? She is so divisive. At the memorial to her funeral, the people who liked her, who loved her, who she made rich, are very offended when other people say that she was absolutely disastrous. You know, I've got a lot of northern friends. I go up north, and you'll find over there there's quite a lot more homogeneity in how people think about her legacy and what they did to the north. There are generations of people still suffering there who've really never, ever gone back to work when she destroyed those kind of mining villages. I think the other thing she did, though, you know, one of her mottos was Tina. Do you remember that? There is no alternative. And I think one of the things she did, which has left a real legacy now, is that she kind of eradicated politics. The opposition between left and right Doesn't really exist now. It didn't really exist once Tony Blair got it.
Right.
The left that we have now, so-called the Labour Party, is, you know, it's absolutely nothing to do with socialism or anything like that. So she took the economy, she turned politics into the economy, that there is only one way of doing things, that is only through neoliberalization, through privatization, through deregulation and defunding of public bodies. And I think one of the things, to go back to what we've been experiencing over the last 4 years, all democracies are funded on not only their political parties, but on this whole apparatus of what we call checks and balances. There's a kind of a civil society that makes sure that no government or no police force or no army or anything and so on can become too autocratic. Now, they have been dismantled by 40 plus years of neoliberalism. And what we saw under lockdown, that there was no one there to hold the government to account for this vast array of fundamentally illegal restrictions that they placed on our human rights. If we just look at the health industry, the health profession, it's really an extension of the pharmaceutical industry. There has been no one who's been able to say, hold on, what on earth are you doing? You know, how could you let these vaccines go through without going through the proper processes? How can you hand over the human rights of the British people to these kind of appointed technocracies like Sage and so on and forth? That is all a legacy of what Thatcher did. When you defund civil society and the institutions which are meant to watch over the government, including the media, of course, which has been absolutely complicit in all this, there is no one to stop a government according itself powers in legislation which are totalitarian powers, they're autocratic powers, which allow them to take away our human rights. That is another big legacy of what Thatcher did. To her, okay, let's give her a little benefit. If she had seen what she had done, I don't think she would have approved of it. I think when she deregulated the City of London and the so-called Big Bang, it created a lot of money for her government for a short while. But I don't think she herself, you know, she's a grocer's daughter. I don't think she would have approved of the sort of financialization of our economy, and not just our economy, but of the global West or the whole globe, that she helped initiate with Reagan and other governments.
Right. She gave birth to a baby that she would have ended up hating. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, right. Very interesting. Thank you. So let us talk to your written work, of which it is substantial. And I think is The Great Reset your most recent book, I believe it
yes,
is. That was December
right.
2023. Well, and as I said at the intro, it literally links together everything that we're experiencing. This week alone, we've heard about the CAS review as one example in response to the sort of transgender madness that has been taking place. You cover that issue in your book, but you cover so much more. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was fascism, because I know you've talked about fascism and how it's completely overused. It is overused, isn't it? But is it fair to say that we are experiencing it now?
Yes. It doesn't really matter what you call it. I think I'm an historian. That's my kind of background. My previous book was called The Road to Fascism. And I started writing it in February of 2021, I think it was. Was it 2022?
And that was out September last year, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And you had things like Justin Trudeau sending in these kind of paramilitaries to beat up the truckers, you know, the truckers convoy. You had incredible levels of police brutality in places like New Zealand and Australia, in Germany, in Austria. People were told if they hadn't got the enforced vaccination program, complied with it, they would be locked into their homes, and if they left, they'd be arrested and sent to camps and stuff. So I started thinking, well, if this sounds like fascism, it certainly looks like it. So I started writing this book to really investigate this as a thesis. Now, fascism is a term which people use historically use themselves. Nobody's going to use the term now. But they found terms which are very similar to it. The key term, which I think The Great Set is bringing us into, is stakeholder capitalism. Now, what that shares with fascism is that it's a technocratic form of governance. What we're seeing at the moment, this is one of the premises of my book, is that for the last 200 odd years, the model of our governance in the West has been around the nation state. It is elected, you elect governments to represent you ostensibly, and they write legislation or they push forward legislation, and we're guided by the rule of law. Now, what happened under lockdown and what has been continued as we've gone into these new crises in Ukraine, in Gaza, and a lot of others, is that we're moving away from that division of powers between the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature, into a technocratic form of governance. Our lives now are not being ruled by Rishi Sunak or Emmanuel Macron, or Georgia Maloney or anything like that. They're being ruled by these transnational technocracies, things like the United Nations or the World Bank. But we've got these new ones now, like the World Health Organization, which is according itself vast powers over us with the pandemic treaty, and of course, the World Economic Forum. In March 2020, ostensibly to address COVID-19, the World Health Organization formed this thing called the COVID Action Platform. And it collected together 1,100, it's now extended to about 1,200, of the most powerful companies in the world. That is, well, that's the model of what stakeholder capitalism is. And they are setting the agenda for what we're doing in the world. It's them who are saying whether we send this money to the Ukraine or whether we don't get involved in Gaza. So in that sense, I think it's not fascism, but the history of fascism has a lot to tell us about how this has happened.
I think it's quite extraordinary. I mean, now when I reflect back on what people endured, I you may not at all be surprised to hear that I really didn't take part in many of the COVID measures, if at all any. And obviously that was constantly problematic for me because many people were so scared and coerced and it was just a horrendous time. But one of the things that I heard you saying actually in a talk that you gave was, and it reminded me, was that how many of their emergency powers that they sought to enact, over 500, right? And none of them had gone through the usual democratic process. I know that where there are a lot of issues in terms of democracy, but these literally had like sidestepped it completely, right? And it just changed us. Are we still changed as a consequence of it?
Yeah, we put something like in 2 years, there was something like 582 coronavirus justified regulations made into law, and 537 of those never went to Parliament. They went to Parliament after they came into law, into effect, into power, and they were kind of rubber stamped in retrospect. My second book, The Great Reset, is about what happens when in March 2022, those regulations were generally, and the Coronavirus Act, were generally revoked. And everyone sort of said, oh, thank goodness that is over. Maybe we didn't behave as well as we should have. Maybe the government was too authoritarian, but we're going back to this new normal now. That's not what happened at all. My book, The Great Reset, was written between two wars. I started writing it when the war on the Ukraine was declared, if you like. Of course, the war itself started back in 2014. But that's when we kind of had this segue. And we had the same level of fear, the same level of crisis kind of management. We weren't officially put under a state of emergency as we were de facto during the COVID crisis or during lockdown. But we've been bombarded with fear constantly. We're constantly told that if we don't stand up for Ukraine and defeat Russia, which is a completely chimerical kind of object, that Russia's somehow going to sweep across Europe and kind of take us all over. But then I published the book, literally, I think it was a week before what's happening in Gaza now, the beginning of the Gaza genocide, was I like to call it the liquidation of the Gaza concentration camp. And that itself is a lie. We're being told at the moment that the war in the Ukraine, the proxy war in the Ukraine, started in February 2022. It didn't. Started back in 2014. In a way, it started back in 1949. We're also told that what is going on in Gaza started in the 7th of October 2023. It didn't. It also started back in 1948. And everything that's happened since then has created the conditions for it. So there's two lies. My book is written between two lies and two wars.
Wow.
There's a very important quote by a Czech writer you might know called Milan Kundera. He was very popular in the 90s. They made a film about one of his books. And he's a Czech writer, so he lived under the Soviet Union when it was part of the Warsaw Pact and so on. And he said in his book, the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And at the moment, we're constantly being told to forget what it was that created the conditions for October the 7th, what it was that created the conditions for Russia annexing the Crimea. We're also being told to forget everything that our governments have done to us over the last 4 years. We need to remember, and partly what I do as a writer, as an investigator, is try to get people to remember what has actually really happened and why we're at this position now. One of the things they said at the beginning of the COVID and the lockdown was, this is an unprecedented situation. There's nothing on this earth that is unprecedented. We need to look to the past to understand the present. That's kind of what I want to do.
And that's exactly why we need historians like you. And because there's another historian that I really rate, I don't know if you know him, Andrew Loney, but he reminds me of you in many respects, because both of you are prepared to go up against the sort of established narrative, against authority. And that's what we need to do. So much of history, of course, as we know, is written by the victor, right? But that's not the history that you're capturing, which I think is so absolutely vital. Simon, I'm so glad that you joined me this morning, but I feel that we've only just kind of touched the, you know, the outsides of a really vital conversation. I'd love you to come back again soon and actually delve deeper into the Great Reset, because it is absolutely contemporary, it is current, and I think that it will enable people in much the same way as I decided to do a psychology degree when I was in my 40s because I wanted to be able to see things that was happening. I think that your book will enable people to see what is happening as it's happening, and I think that is, that's, there's a real powerful a drive and motivation attached to that. Simon, thank you for joining us this morning on today's News Talk. This is Dr. Simon Elmer, everybody, who's not only told us about the legacy of Margaret Thatcher, but has enabled us to see with some clarity where we are right now as a consequence of fascism. Yes, fascism. Simon, take excellent care of yourself and have a wonderful weekend. And we will be right back.